David Cowan is a visiting scholar here at the Boise Center during the spring 2014 semester, where he's researching diplomacy and communication regarding religion and American foreign policy, with a focus on Christianity and Islam. A senior tutor in politics and religion at King's Evangelical Divinity School, an approved tutor at the University of Chester, he's also a communications advisor with over 25 years of experience working for such organizations as the World Bank and the Institute of Islamic Banking and Finance and Insurance. Excuse me. He's the author of the book Strategic Internal Communication, which is out shortly, right?
In June.
Yes. And also a book entitled Economic Parables, The Monetary Teachings of Jesus Christ, among many other writings. He's a regular reviewer for the Journal of Theological Studies. His PhD is from the University of St. Andrews, jointly undertaken in the School of Divinity and the School of International Relations. And he has a BTH and MTH, a bachelor's and master's from the University of Oxford, an MLit from University of St. Andrews, and a diploma in theology from Westfield House, Cambridge, where he was Lutheran chaplain to the University of Cambridge. So he's had a little bit of education under his belt, along with a lot of experience. We're delighted to have you today, David, to speak about this great topic. So welcome.
Thank you. So, first of all, I want to thank the Boise Center for appointing me this semester and giving me an intellectual home for a while to explore some of the ideas which I'm going to share with you this afternoon. It's a great facility here, and of course a wonderful campus that BC has. Being somebody who's been through Oxford, Cambridge, St. Andrews, I know a good Harry Potter set. Right? So it's kind of nice to see BC. But what I wanted to concentrate on today is communication, the modern world of communication. If anybody can improve on this hashtag and social media, they're welcome to try, but that's the best I could do in terms of shortening it. But it was a way of sort of explaining a little bit about the kind of communications environment that we're going into. So the agenda today is really to look at three things. One is modern communication, some trends and challenges there. Then to look specifically at church communication, but I think it applies to other religious groups as well. And then an outline of some theological research which I'm doing connecting the two. After about 25 years experience in communications and more education in theology than is probably good for one person, I thought it was good to sort of try and match the two. And it's taken me a long time to do that, really, to sort of think, how do you reflect theologically on communication when it's something you've been doing for so long in different ways. I've been a journalist, headed corporate communications, internal communications for a major industrial company, for a major financial institution, for a public institution, the World Bank. I advise currently to one of the three biggest global media agencies in the world. And so I've sort of seen it from every conceivable angle, I think, except I've never done consumer-type communication. But working in that, I could never really see the wood for the trees. So that's partly why I'm here at the Boise Center. I should, before I proceed further, there are some images which you may find slightly distasteful, but so I can only apologise for those in advance, but those come a little bit later. Now you're going to ignore everything, aren't you?
When's it coming?
when's it coming? I once used the F word in an essay, and my marker said he felt awfully naughty in making notice of this, and he said it's the first time he was able to use the F word in an essay, marking it as well. But anyway, I was quoting, admittedly quoting myself from another essay, but anyway. So what we live in today, really, the 21st century of communication, is a kind of modern Babel, I think, and there are lots of trends that we could talk about. But we don't have the whole day to go through this. So I want to single out what I think are three of the core trends. One is globalization. When I started working as a journalist in finance, it became quite commonplace to talk about globalization at the end of the sort of mid to late 80s. I'm not as young and handsome as I look. And it was common in business, but it wasn't commonplace elsewhere. And it's a word that's grown as the world itself has globalized. And a lot of that, I think, has been driven by the economy. That's sort of broken down barriers of time and space. The second trend is technology. We now, the cost of communicating is about 10,000th of what it was in 1970 for us to communicate. If you look even at the social media space, for most people it's free. I mean, there's a whole economy as to why that's the case, but you don't need to go and buy a stamp and buy notepads and send letters and wait for ages now. You can do it instantaneously, which for some people should be discouraged. But I think the third trend is one of transparency, and the flip side of that being surveillance, that we are more watched than we are. I have a colleague at St. Andrews who's done a whole lot of research in this, actually, but it's... you know, wherever we go, we are watched, we are filmed, we are recorded. But the flip side of that is also transparency. It's much harder to hide things, much harder to hide the past, much harder to hide the things that we're doing. It's harder in business to cheat. All of these things still go on, but there is increasing transparency in the world. And I think these are the three things that anyone who's working in communications has to have an understanding and a position on in terms of how they're going to communicate. And the challenges of that are kind of good and bad. It challenges culture. It's very hard for a country to be, or an area to be, monocultural. In America, you had probably up till the 50s, and maybe even early 60s, a fairly narrow culture for most purposes, and that is now being exposed more and more so, not just with more immigration, but your exposure to the outside world. And also diversity is increased, diversity in all sorts of ways, whether we're talking about colour, gender, or belief systems and so on. So it's very hard to not be exposed to other ideas and other beliefs and other ways of looking at things. Another challenge is the management of content. It's much harder to control your message in the media space that we now work in. I'll give an example. HMV, an entertainment retailer in the United Kingdom, fired 65 people one day, which is no big news, except for the 65 people losing their jobs. But the normal thing for a company in the past would have been to control that messaging as to what the impact was, and they could control it through good PR people like myself. However, on this occasion, with social media, and this is a warning to the interns among you, the intern had built their social media. And so she was able to hack into the system, and she tweeted live. It's very funny. I've printed it in my book, actually. So it's very funny. She was very witty. But she tweeted live the firing process. And down to the fact that the marketing manager wanted to close down the world's social media to stop this and so on. It's very funny. And so it became big news across the media. You know, 65 jobs. It would have been a story you could control, lost control. All down to one person, their imagination, the access to the right tools to do the job. The other side of that is that we're also deluged by content and information. We're bombarded with it. So it's very difficult. How do we actually manage the amount of information and data that we are hit with? It's harder and harder to come up with, say, the top 50 books that you must read. Your sort of bucket lists are becoming broader and broader. And the third challenge is really the transmission of ideas. How do you get ideas? How do you get people engaged? How do you get people behind your ideas? And I'll touch on that one a little bit in a few moments. Because the outcome of that is really the crisis of authority. So who authorizes? Who says that this is authoritative information, true information? I'm sure you all have stories that you've read and believed something that's been presented as a fact, which later turns out that it was never true, but it takes on a life of its own. I recently made a reference online to Sarah Palin, which I won't go into, but she was popularly said, thanks to Tina Fey, that she could see Russia from a house, which she didn't actually say, but everybody believed it. It was part of the hammer that was constantly used to beat her. On the other side, President Obama, you know, he was born in Kenya, apparently, and you know, there's documentation online that will prove that for you, and people believe this stuff. So, what do you believe? How do you choose? Nobody's telling you what to believe. You don't have, like in my case, growing up as a kid in the 60s, you don't have the man from the BBC telling you this is the way the world is. And part of that crisis of authority is for quite most of the people in this room, being millennials, I think, is that you actually can consider yourselves as politically independent and religiously unaffiliated. And I think that's connected to the authority of the way in which you're choosing what you believe, how you believe, how you practice your belief, whether it's political, religious, or otherwise. But this is good research from the Pew Center. Another outcome is that you have minority views and access. I mean, that's the good side of it, that it is easier for minority groups to get their views out there. It's great that people have access to the internet and they can get their thoughts and ideas. They don't need to sell it to a journalist who has to sell it to an editor to get it published. They can go online, open up a Facebook page and run a campaign. So I think there are opportunities there. But because you've got more people coming into this space, you've got what I call the communication noise. And how do you get our attention? With so many people communicating, so much information deluging you, how do you actually get through that? And what we've kind of got is something of a need for dialogue. Because what you've got is a lot of what I call shout fest. Some people call it American television. You know, they're just shouting at each other. You can watch Fox News and then switch over to MSNBC and watch that. And you could have the two on at the same time because the technology is cheap enough. You can have two TVs and just watch them going at it. And people will watch Fox to reinforce their views. They will watch MSNBC to reinforce their views. You know, what's happened to public debate? What's happened to dialogue? I think that's the space we've met. Now I think comes the offensive bit. These are the kinds of ways that we're increasingly getting the attention. largely, sex and profanity seem to be the main ways to be able to do this. But there are also shocking ways, like 9/11. That got the world's attention. Le Monde said, you know, we're all New Yorkers now, which it stopped being after a while, but that's Le Monde. But you've got the kind of almost the pornography that's being used in terms of selling products. You've got Madonna and others who use religion as a way to try and shock. You've got people who want to be offensive on Facebook, and you've got book titles like the two there. And what doesn't get shown, oddly enough, and the reason I put it in is this one in the bottom corner there of a beheading in, I don't know where this is, but it looks like it could be Saudi. which is regularly shown on television. So you will watch Arab news, and they will show you the beheading multiple times or a shooting multiple times that you censor here, but you watch it as entertainment. And that's a whole debate in itself as to why you promote violence in a form of entertainment and then you go and censor the real thing. I'm not quite sure. That's maybe a question we can come back to. Now, in that sort of space, how then does the church communicate? So I talked a bit about some of the communication things, so we can come back to any one of those things if you wish afterwards. I think the trends for the church in thinking about communication is twofold, two major trends. One is secularization, which is well understood now. But the secularization thesis was that we would all grow up in this nice, sophisticated world that we have, and we would forsake religion and put away our childish toys. And the news was, in the last decade or so, that religion has made a definite comeback. Probably goes back further than that. The Islamic Revolution in Iran, I think, sort of made people aware that religion was having a major role to play. I think Pope John Paul II's work in the downfall of communism is another example. So there are other. It didn't all start at 9/11. I think it happened before then, but religion is definitely making a comeback. What you've now got is a lot of people in social sciences scrambling to learn about religion because they were taught you didn't need to worry about it because all religions are the same. They all preach the same thing and all roads lead to God, and that's all you need to know. You can ignore it now, unless you're treating it as a sociological phenomenon. But religion's coming back, I think, in the kind of way that Marx worried about it as an opiate. Or the way that religious people would like religion to be on the agenda. But having said that, the churches are in something of a sometimes desperate search for relevance. How does the church, in all this space that I've described, how does the church actually make itself relevant? How do you communicate ideas like sin and salvation, the kingdom of God, all these things? How do you actually communicate that to a hashtag kind of world? And we'll come back to that in a minute. Because the challenges that they face are, one is that the content, I talked earlier about the management of content, the content of the faith remains doctrine. And doctrine has become a bit of a dirty word in itself, or dogma. We shouldn't have these things. Let's kind of lighten the mood a little bit. And I think that's actually a bad move. I think the church does need to be much definite on doctrine. And again, I'm going to come back to that in a moment. Another challenge, I think, is the control of language. The church is a foreign country for many people. Going back again to sort of 50s, 60s, 70s, it was taken for granted a lot of young people would go to Sunday school, they would then become teenagers, drive their parents crazy, which is why we sent ours to boarding school, we subcontracted them, and then they would come back and sort of start having kids in realities of their own and would start to come back into the fold. And most people who are converts to religion as adults were actually at church as youth. I think the statistics bear that out, rather than being completely new converts. The completely new converts usually join the new age, the new sort of big churches, that the intensity of their religious practice is so much that they burn out, and some of them got scooped up by the traditional churches, others just go into some other kind of belief system. But you know, we're losing control of the language. And by that, I don't just mean language like sin and salvation and Jesus as a profanity. It doesn't mean any more than that. Not just talking about that, but also the language of liturgy, the language of the church space, the worship space. People walking into a church, you can't take for granted they know what to do or how to follow the liturgy. And they certainly don't memorize the liturgy. So it's quite a difficult place for people to walk into fresh. I think there's also changes in the religious debate, and a lot of popular religious debate centres much more around questions of general spirituality, you know, what, and it's very emotional, you know, it's what I think and what I, or rather it's what I feel, and get in touch with my inner self, and it's very individualistic. Another aspect is the discussion of ethics, and there is an argument to be made there's no such thing as Christian ethics, it's just, you know, ethics is just part of it. You're just repeating yourself by saying Christian ethics, because Christianity is an ethic. And then legalism. A lot of discussion goes on around what you can and cannot do, what the rules are, rather than in the kind of spirit of the law. And in a nation that seems to have a love-hate relationship with lawyers. I don't need to say much more about legalism. I think what you need to do, the biggest challenge covering all these, is also finding a basis for dialogue between faiths. Because of the secularization thing, the idea that all religions were basically the same and said the same thing, there was a pretense in dialogue, interfaith dialogue, that we can all talk together because we believe and we want the same things. I would argue, and I'll put this in conclusion as well, that actually we should have dialogue on the basis that we don't agree with each other, and in some cases we don't even really like each other. And we do have fundamental differences. If you take Jesus, not as a profanity, but as an individual, to Christians, he's a son of God. To Jews, he's a heretic. To secularists, he's a good man up there with Mahatma Gandhi and Nelson Mandela, and so on. Now, all of these are mutually exclusive statements. You can't just say they're all true. So very superficial, yes, you can talk about love, justice, peace and all that stuff, but once you get down deeper, there is a doctrine, there is a set of beliefs, and it does mean something to say, I believe in Jesus Christ as my saviour, than to say that he's just this good guy who told us nice things to do. So, talking about nice things to do then, what is the Christian public square? And I think it's a rather miserable place at times. We got all this sort of... just as I talked about the Fox, MSNBC, that's been replicated in the religious square, and it's left and right. And everybody saying, liberals telling other liberals how to be good liberals, and conservatives telling other conservatives how to be good conservatives, and you don't believe this, therefore you must be a rhino, and all this sort of thing goes on. And it's just this constant squabbling, and this happens within the Christian public square about, you know, the role of the Constitution, attacking the Christian right as being fascist, who the real Jesus was, and then of course let's also devote some of that disgust towards Islam. So I think in a way you could characterise the Christian public square as a very unhelpful place to be, or a very worrying place to be. And to people outside of Christianity, this is what they see. They don't see all the nice stuff, because bad news sells. We actually like bad things, and we want to hear that before we hear the good things. You don't hear somebody coming onto TV and saying, oh, look, here's somebody who's just done this great thing. It becomes a human interest story, it's not news. We want to hear about a fire down in downtown Boston. We want to hear about a train crash. We want to hear about a plane missing, all that sort of thing. And these are important news. I'd love to talk a little bit about Princess Diana and the night she died, but I don't think we have time for that. But it's just kind of priorities that we seem to have. And so we have a bit of an image problem, I think, in the church, that a lot of people's views are informed by the God delusion, the Da Vinci Code, the Vatican Bank, conflicts between Christianity and the... you may find this cartoon particularly offensive. Sorry, it's gone onto an automatic loop, I think, there. So it's probably just as well to jump through those cartoons anyway. And the church's response has been to say, well, we can do some hip happening stuff as well. And these are some examples. JesusTattoo.org, Hard Act to Follow, and Body Piercing, Jesus Had This Done 2,000 Years Ago. The problem I have with this is, and I'm speaking specifically and from communications experience, there is something that companies now have which they define as brand promise, and I could spend the day just talking about why that's just brand is so much hokum anyway. It's basically moving on from the fact that the advertising industry was running into revenue issues and needed to come up with a new gig to take into business, but I won't go into that. But what the current theory is, and the one I dispute, is that you're trying to build a brand promise. And that's what you do when you advertise. This is presenting the church as a brand. But if you're going to promise a brand, you have to match it with what the experience is of that brand. So if you have Starbucks as a brand promise of being some sort of boho type of experience, you go and have coffee, you go in and you want to see these baristas doing all sorts of stuff with your coffee. Frankly, I just want black coffee with three sugars, but you want to go and sit in comfy chairs, get Wi-Fi and all this sort of imagery, brand promise that's been given to you, and you want that experience. That's what you're expecting. You don't want sort of hard top tables, no Wi-Fi access, and chairs that you can only sit in for about 5 minutes before getting a pain. Now, for the church, if you're promising this kind of brand, I'm sorry, the experience doesn't match. Yeah, if I see this and I think, oh, that sounds hip, you know, that looks good, I'll go and see what the Church of England is about. And you walk into some church in the middle of nowhere in England and there's about 12 pensioners sitting mumbling the liturgy and moaning through the hymns. And I'll speak as somebody who does moan through hymns. that you're not getting the brand experience. The only body piercing you're going to see in a church is somebody's hip replacement. you're not matching that brand promise. And I think this is one of the mistakes that the church makes in so many ways in its search for relevance. It's trying to ape the society and not actually have some contention with society. Which brings me to the theology of the stuff. And there are three areas which I'm sort of focusing on, and these are not conclusions, these are areas I'm exploring. If you go to the Bible, it's actually quite good on communications. I've even described the communications process in terms of how the Bible was formed, which was much to the surprise of the middle managers I was speaking to in Luxembourg, but one of them said he actually woke up because I started speaking about the Bible and he wondered what the heck was going on. but three areas. One is prophecy. If you look at the prophetic speeches, they are seeking to speak to our situation. They do really reach deep. They're also countercultural in their narrative. They raise the possibility of arguing against the culture, asking what people want, which is not necessarily what they need. And it's also deals very much with the dissonance that we have between the way we're living our life, the way we think we should live our life, and prophecy speaks to that. And it's all, there's also quite good at inspiring the imagination. There's some good imagery used by the prophets. So that's one area. Second area I mentioned earlier a little bit was the parables. Jesus is very good at making an audience connection. And he doesn't start off saying, I'm going to give you a lecture about the kingdom of God. He says, I'm going to talk about a woman who lost the coin. I'm going to talk about a sower in the fields. Things that people understood in order to take them to where he wants to take them to. And I think that actually offers some opportunities in the social media space in terms of how you get doctrine into such a simple place. Well, Jesus did actually manage to do that, I think, 2,000 years ago. because he was starting from where they were, and that's what we need to understand culture, not ape it, but understand it in order to understand how we communicate to it. And also the use of metaphor and simile, and that's kind of taken that he then took them into the deeper meaning for the disciples as they learned. They got more into what the parables actually meant. And then the third, very briefly, is the missionary speeches. Again, these are in the book of Acts. They're very clear, objective, understanding the message. It's presented very clearly. There is an awareness of culture and beliefs. Multiculturalism wasn't invented in the 20th century. It did exist then. You know, in Christ there is neither Gentile nor Jew. There was an awareness there were different cultures, and everybody hated the Romans. Also, there's the maintaining of maintaining the value of the message in contrast to the audience. So the audience may not like what they're hearing, but the missionary speeches stand up for what they believe in. And I think there's a sense of trajectory of the narrative journey that runs through the missionary speeches and Acts. So I'm kind of exploring that biblical aspect. And then some historical reminders, which I run through very quickly. One is that the biblical books themselves originate in the oral tradition. The early church used pagan forms of communication, for example, rhetoric, in developing its own speech as it grew. Augustine, which I'm kind of interested in, said that communication was neutral. And that's just something I want to kind of look at. Later on, you get prohibition on the use of images. When images are a very strong form of communication. You get the print revolution in the Reformation, which was a big change in the first, if I was to put communications into three ages, which may be a bit simplistic, I would say it's the first was writing, when we actually learned to write. The second was the print revolution in the Reformation and the Renaissance that spread information, made it accessible in people's own language. And then third is the current one of the last 20 years or so of the technological and social media revolution, which is changing again the access and the way in which we deal with communication. And so we have modern mass communication, which has been used in different ways, like televangelists have been very good at harnessing it. I can't cope with them, but they do it very well. I mentioned here the life of Brian because Acres, I love it. I think it's theologically the most authentic movie that's ever been made. But we can talk about recently, blessed are the cheesemakers. But there was a whole protest by evangelicals and I think Roman Catholics in this country against the movie for being an insult to Jesus, who doesn't actually feature in the film, except when he's in distance doing the Sermon on the Mount. And then, of course, the new media attacks, which I referred to in the earlier public square slide. And so what I want to... This is basically the theological agenda, and I'll finish on this that I'm exploring. One is I want to understand what it means to understand God as a communicative God. When I've had to teach philosophy of religion, I start from the point that it's the simple proposition, there's either God or there's not a God. You either believe that it's God or there's not a God. Agnosticism is the coward's way out. You either believe or you don't believe. If there is a God, so let's assume there is a God, then God has chosen to communicate with us. And how is God communicated with us? So I want to explore that and what that means in terms of the way we communicate today and replicate any aspects of God's communication to us. Is it a two-way dialogue and so on? The second is I want to explore a return to doctrine, albeit modernized, but we shouldn't lose the sense of the rich history and doctrine of the church and of the faith. And that we should also... understand what we're trying to do when we communicate. And instead of having this public square, this nasty place, that we need to create dialogue space and healing and being much better negotiators in the public square. Instead of trying to convert people or convince them of our point of view, just being there as dialogue partners, not trying to convert. And interfaith, I mentioned earlier, I think accepting that we actually disagree. And then this is a quote, if I'm allowed to quote from my own work, from a book review I did on Reinhold Niebuhr in the Journal of Theological Studies. And in approaching the public square, I think the Christian left and Christian right need to engage with each other to seek a better Christianity before trying to teach the body politic a better secularity. And I kind of want to explore a little bit more of that. I think that brings me to the end.
Great.
Have I kept within time?
We're good.
Yeah, good. Thanks a lot. Perhaps we'll rush through it, but at least I didn't collapse into a cough.
Great. We have 10 or 15 minutes or so for a conversation. So the floor is open to you all for any questions or comments. Yeah,
sure. You spoke about the issue of surveillance, and former President Jimmy Carter this week spoke about how when he reaches out to world leaders, he writes letters now instead of sending emails because he feels that the NSA is going to read them and invade his privacy. And I was going to say, do you see a future when we kind of take a step backwards in terms of communication for fear of surveillance? I mean, how do you see this going forward? Because it's very, I think it's a very big issue if we have a former president saying he doesn't feel comfortable using email anymore.
I think the genie's out of the bottle. It's hard to see how, unless there was some sort of major movement that could bring that about. And humanity has been through many sort of shifts. I can't at the moment imagine what sort of shift could take place that suddenly we would take away that. Surveillance. It may happen over a course of time that people just sort of get sick of it, and people. My generation have sort of taken the pendulum from one end to the other. My father's attitude, if I got into a fight as a kid, and I did get into fights as a kid, was that if a kid hit me, then that was my problem. And sort it out yourself. He was Scottish, which explains a lot. that was parenting, you know? And we've gone to the other extreme where we completely mollycoddle our kids, and some of you are an outcome of that we've been overprotective, we don't want any harm to happen. We've become extremely risk averse, in fact, whereas risk is a part of human life, and it's a little bit like you need to be exposed to bacteria in order to survive some of the things that can happen. But we're striving for a level, I think, of perfection in terms of the way that we do all these things, and surveillance is just one of those streams of if we can watch everything going on, then we can keep the world safe. And it's nonsense, because the only effective way to detect a bomb at an airport is not to stand in one of those things being humiliated or getting patted down in a search. The only really effective way is a dog. You get dogs on the job, they're nice, but they're the only ones who can actually detect bombs. All these little screens do is you have some guy sitting there, bored to tears, watching to say, oh, that looks strange, and take it out. That's why you sometimes can accidentally leave stuff in your luggage and it goes through. So we will always bedevil ourselves. And maybe at some point, maybe your generation will come up with a level of sophistication that says, look, all this surveillance is nonsense, let's rip it out, because it's an invasion of privacy or whatever. On the other hand, I think the thing that President Carter is referring to, maybe the NSA would want to look at his emails, but for the vast majority of people, there's not people sitting there in little offices looking, oh, this is really good for the emails. Yeah, that's what they're saying. Or whatever it is, it's just done by a program that's just churning through this like face recognition software, and it's looking for unusual patterns. And then they will go and look at it. They're not sitting there reading everybody's tedious emails. Hopefully not mine.
Yours aren't tedious.
So, yeah, but it's hard to see the pendulum swinging back, but I assume it will do, because that's what we tend to do with things.
Yeah, other questions? Good.
In terms of media, how do you see the best way to reach a universal audience? And do you see that being in terms of secularization? I'm reading Schleiermacher in one of my classes that Father Michael Hans is teaching, and he wrote to an audience in a way that took the religious content out, so it would apply to ubiquitous type of audience. So do you see that as a good entering in point to reach all types of people?
I wouldn't quite take Schleiermacher's view, because you just end up with exactly what the secularization thesis thought they would achieve, that we would all just become believers and love peace and all that jazz. And religious belief is rather more stubborn than that. And there is, as I say, a rich tradition of doctrine and belief that we have inherited and are curators of for a period of time. That we should hold on to. There's a lot of good stuff, and of course, you know, we should believe in something, and we should be prepared for the fact that we disagree with what other people believe in. I'm more concerned about the nature of the debate than the content of the debate, and the way in which people have become much more aggressively opposed to each other and can't seem to engage in dialogue and agree and to disagree at some point. And that, I think, that approach, I think, is a little bit of a coward's way out. It's about saying, well, let's not talk about the real stuff. I think the parabolic approach that Jesus had is a much more useful way to go about it, and the ways I described in that one slide of what can we talk about that leads people to where we want to take them to. And the problem is that and this happens on the left and right. They go, say, into the political arena and say, oh, this is wrong, or that's right, and this policy is right. The church has often backed bad policies, and people have different views as to what policy is going to achieve an end. And I would suggest the church should get out the policy business and be in the business of being a space for dialogue. Much more so. And then it can become relevant, and then you start to be recognized for the way you behave, and we're much more influenced now by behaviour, and much more aware of behaviour than perhaps people paid attention to in the past. And if the church can behave in a better way, and Christians within it can behave in a better way, then they might communicate better. But I don't think it's about pretending, well, let's water it down or secularise it to become relevant. I think that's failed.
Good.
How do you feel about bumper stickers as a form of communication?
Oh, I mean, they're fun. I mean, there's a lot of fun stuff on the internet. I don't want to be a killjoy about all of this. My Old Testament tutor used to have a bumper sticker that said, Jesus saves, not on my salary, he doesn't. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of cute stuff. And I love on YouTube, I love the Numa Numa guy. I mean, he must be a very sad person, but I think it's fun to watch what he did. I don't know if you remember the Numa Numa guy, but it's fun. You should look it up, N-U-M-A. And he's just sitting in his basement, lip syncing to an East European pop song nobody had heard of, but it's good fun. So there's a lot of fun, and it can get attention. I mean, headlines are a form of bumper sticker. It gets your attention to read the story, so it draws you in. And again, I guess in a way, Jesus is the discussion of the mustard seed is his form of a bumper sticker. Mm-hmm.
Let me give you a final wrap-up question then. We're looking at, in Turkey right now, an attempt by the government to shut down YouTube today, Twitter 6 or 7 days ago, and to put a lock on social media. What do you think are the process? We've seen this, you know, take over of BlackBerry networks and attempts to shut down networks in Egypt and other places. You spent a lot of time in the Middle East. What are the prospects for free speech beyond authoritarian grasp in the social networking world?
That was a huge question.
Well, I told you you had a minute and a half. So should be plenty.
Well, actually, I was 6 months out in Saudi Arabia last year, and Saudi is the number one YouTube consumer. Because their traditional media is censored. But because the government, which means the royal family, doesn't actually understand social media, they just pretend it doesn't exist. That's all the kids. There's a great YouTube video that was done by a Saudi comedian, and they do exist, which was about women being able to drive, and he did it to Bob Marley's song, it was No Woman, No Drive. It was really funny. And they don't know how to cope with it. And Saudi is quite an authoritarian regime, just not militaristic, in the sense that, say, Turkey is. But it's hard to see how they can control the means of communication. Because the last time that sort of really happened in the fostering of evil was probably Nazi Germany. And Nazi Germany is an amazing communications case study if you wanted to do it. The whole use of the imagery. Hugo Boss suits, which was a big thing in the 80s, were the designers of human military German military uniforms. Their whole use of film, the films of Leni Riefenstahl, are amazing forms of propaganda communication. But that's because you could have that control. Social media makes that much harder, and it's hard to see how you can really legislate for it. You have the same issue in a different way with pornography. You know, it's so prevalent and highly used that you sometimes wonder who the real beneficiaries are of social media. But it's just very difficult to control. How do governments actually censor pornography now in your traditional liberal Western democracies? How can you do that? Can you do it? Should you do it? And the flip side is when you're trying to protect a regime like in Turkey and so on, it's very hard to control those because you don't own the means of communication production like you do with the television station, the radio station, the newspapers, because physically you can go and shut them down. It's much harder to do with computers where somebody can just leave the country, log into Wi-Fi at the airport and make a movie and tell you what's going on in that country.
Well, on that hopeful note, thank all of you for being here, but especially thank you, David, for a terrific talk.